All right. We'll take up our merits docket. Denise Hawkins versus Donna Greasy. Am I pronouncing that name correctly?
Is it Greasy?
Greasy. I'm sorry.
Greasy.
I apologize. You can come up to council table and who will be arguing for the appellant?
I will. Beth Luttrell, Your Honor, for the appellant.
Ms. Luttrell, you'll have 15 minutes and you can reserve any part of that time for rebuttal.
Excellent. Let me ask a preliminary question.
Sure.
Is this being broadcast in terms of or recorded for
It is being recorded. At some point, it will be uploaded to our website, I believe. You can certainly request a copy. You may have to pay for a copy through the clerk's office if that's your wish. But
my concern is the privacy of the child, and recognizing that, we'll use initials.
That's fine.
Okay.
Why don't we just use initials? And that would be helpful, I think, to protect the child.
Yeah.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That's our practice for your benefit. That's our practice with the opinion anyway. So.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's your appellant, so. And Ms. Petrillo, if you'll advise us, how much time do you have to reserve?
I'd like to reserve 5 minutes, Your Honor.
5 minutes,
thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the courts. My name is Beth Luttrell, and along with co-counsel Barbara Fuller, I represent Denise Hawkins, the appellant in this matter. This case is about the custody of a 10-year-old child who, until the lower court's ruling for all of his 10 years, has always been in the joint physical custody of the two adults who brought him into the world.
Counsel, let me interrupt you and kind of cut to the chase here.
Sure.
There are a number of issues, I think, that we're going to have to wrestle with here. Let me just... I know the circuit court dealt with the issue of whether your client... met the test of the interested party, but I know your primary argument is focusing on basically the issue of parentage, and I guess derivative of that is the marriage issue. Do you want to focus on that?
Actually, Your Honor, there are three reasons we believe that the lower court's decision is error. The first is because under Virginia law, under the exceptional circumstances test, as it exists, the evidence presented met that threshold test. The lower court looked at the evidence, agreed that...
Which test are we talking about?
The exceptional circumstances test
for the
person with a legitimate interest to be able to reach the child's best interest in order to have a best interest hearing, which would...
Excuse me, the trial court found that it would be detrimental to the child to sever relations with the appellant, and a parent-child relationship existed between them.
Exactly right, Your Honor.
Factual findings.
That's exactly right.
The trial court went on to say, but you didn't rebut the presumption.
That's exactly right.
My question is, what else do you need to rebut the presumption?
Your Honor, we believe that those two factors in and of themselves, and in addition, if the court were so to find that the intention of the parties in creating this child, so even before he was born, the court could look at the intention of the parties who decided to have a child together, to bring into their family unit, to raise jointly, who did raise that child jointly, and who created this parent-child relationship that the child necessarily relies on. All of those factors necessarily meets the threshold test. And the court itself said that it would appeal its ruling if it could. It found it would be detrimental. It weighed the reasoning of the lower court, reasoned that on one hand it found this child will suffer. That's what the court said. But on the other hand, there's a biological relationship with the parent that has a superior right. It weighed those two interests and found that biology trumps all.
Well, looking at the circumstances, it's not an exclusive list of circumstances that can rebut the presumption, but I gather from your argument and from your brief that your focus is primarily on number five, which is the special facts and circumstances, and we're not dealing with abandonment or any of the other factors there. Is that a fair assumption on my part?
That's right, Your Honor.
So the question really is, from our standpoint, appellate review standpoint, is whether or not special facts and circumstances exist in the light most favorable to the prevailing party below, because if it's a presumption in favor of the parent, then the you have to rebut the presumption, basically.
Right.
And so I guess the problem for us, or maybe you can see a way around it for us, but the problem for us is that we don't weigh the facts. And while we might have been, any one of us individually might have come to a different conclusion had we been the trial, you know, the circuit court judge in this case, that's not our standard of review. The standard of review is there evidence in the record that supports the trial court's finding? So where you have a presumption that's not rebutted, it seems to me the argument necessarily is, well, you didn't carry your burden of persuasion. How do we review that from the standpoint of an appellate court without becoming fact finders and basically doing a de novo review? If I were the judge, I would have done something differently, therefore the judge was wrong, which of course what we're not supposed to.
Yes, sir. I understand the question. And the answer is, what the court did was say, based on these findings, the law, as I understand it, the court said, legally, I am constrained by the law. This was a ruling on a matter of law that said the findings here don't rise to the level. And we are saying that that is a reversible error.
Not to interrupt you. Part of what the trial court said, though, is that Virginia does not recognize de facto parenting or
parenthood,
however you wish to phrase it. How do you get around that factor?
Two answers, Your Honor. First, under the facts and circumstances here, the court doesn't have to find de facto parenthood in order to find that the facts are exceptional. When two adults decide to bring a child into the family unit, especially at a time when the law unconstitutionally prevents a path to parenthood for the non-biological parent.
Well,
and then,
but we can't really get to the marriage issue. It's really a custody issue, is that fair to say? I can't, if there's a thought that there could have some implication, but what we have before us is simply just the custody part of it.
That's correct, Your Honor. What I'd like to suggest is that the court could, as a matter of law, and certainly as applied here, rule that under these facts, where a child is intended to be born through a preconception agreement between two adults, to be raised by them jointly, who is raised by them jointly, and who has, where the evidence shows there's a significant parent-child relationship that, if severed, will cause harm. So if those factors are met, you don't have to get to a de facto parentage.
In the Bales case, where it fails with the stepmother, the psychiatrist or psychologist indicated not that there would be some, but in fact, something would be tantamount to this is he, his whole world is the stepmom. And so is there a factual distinguishing element with what allowed the Bales court to get beyond the presumption versus what we have factually here? Well, that kind of relates back to what Judge Harper said about the facts.
If in Bales or any other case that has been before the court, there were exact circumstances that had come before, then we'd have a test that says, in these circumstances, that's exceptional circumstances. That's not what this court, that's not the rule of law. In fact, courts have said it's the totality of the circumstances that we look at this on a case-by-case basis. And in this case, exceptional circumstances should be found.
Well, our case law is pretty clear that, in our statutes for that matter, pretty clear that parentage comes from either biology or adoption. There's no other mechanism to become a parent that's at least currently recognized in Virginia law. Given that, it seems to me the vehicle for, and visitation is not before us. The only issue before us is the issue of custody. It seems to me then, if we're restricting our analysis to whether your client has rebutted the presumption in favor of a parent, And number five is the only one that we're talking about, special facts and circumstances. And Judge Malvo mentioned Bales, but in Bales, it's special facts and circumstances constituting an extraordinary reason for taking a child from its parent or parents. And if your client is not a parent, then it seems to me the problem is, and I guess this was the problem for the circuit court too, is if your client has rebutted the presumption, the effect is that the child is being taken from the person who clearly does qualify as a parent, the biological parent.
What would happen is, just to be clear about the effect of that, the decision that the circumstances are exceptional, is that the child gets a best interest determination, and yes, the result of that...
That comes after the presumption is rebutted. That's when the best interest determination is made.
Correct.
We don't get there until the court finds that the presumption is rebutted.
Correct. So just to...
If we make that decision, don't we have to remand it back to the circuit court for determination of best interest?
We're asking this court to reverse and remand in order to allow this child, who knows only two adults as his only two parents, who relies on both of them as his only two parents, to do what it does in every other case involving a child born into a planned family with a parent-child relationship, to determine his needs and interests based on his best interests. I would say not only is the exceptional circumstances met here under Virginia law as it is, under these circumstances, as I've laid them out, with a clear rule of law that could say, going forward, under these circumstances, a child should be recognized as having, non-parent should be found to have overcome the burden because it doesn't violate the natural parent's rights, which is what we're protecting here. But also, every court that has looked at this question since Obergefell, since intervening authority has recognized that the situation has changed, that the understanding now is children are harmed. When two parents, same-sex parents, bring children into their family and create parent-child relationships...
Respectfully, we're limited to what's on the record in terms of what the testimony's been in reference to the impact upon the child. Is that fair to say?
Then
I'm understanding there may be literature that says other things, but we only can look at the record before us.
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely. And the court only needs to look at the record to find,
well,
as I suggest.
Well, in Obergefell, the issue was marriage.
That's right, Your Honor. But
not parents.
The underpinning of Obergefell is that these children are harmed, just as this child is.
If you were to carry your argument to its logical conclusion, mm-hmm. It seems to me that any time you had two individuals of whatever gender, any combination of genders, who one of whom has a child from a prior relationship or whatever, and they are not married, but they live together for some length of time, long enough for the other individual, the non-biological parent, to bond with the child. In every single case, then, we have an arguable situation where the non-biological partner, if you will, or you know, whatever the relationship is, would have a claim of ongoing relationship with the child.
That would be true. That's not what I'm asking for.
That's not what you're asking for, but that is
seems
to be the logical
determinant of the best interest of the child.
That's true, but even before you get there, I mean, the court and the guardian ad litem's well-founded concern for allowing a broad de facto parentage doctrine is remedied by a narrow application, which is what the court, post-Obergefell state courts, just this past week, Vermont joined three other states after their states recognized the harm that comes to children that was identified in Obergefell. We mentioned three of them in our brief, but again, the Vermont Supreme Court just recognize that the rulings, the rule of law that fails to put two parents in a same-sex relationship who are prevented from marrying each other when the child is born on equal footing, the inability to reach that child's best interest does a grave harm and needs to be reexamined.
Everything you're just saying is absolutely correct. The problem is it all begins with the proposition talking about parents. And parents, at least in the Commonwealth of Virginia, have a very definitive definition. I wouldn't say it's narrow, but it certainly is not broad to the extent that it's based on the nature of an abstract relationship. It's based on, you know, recognized common law principles.
As is the law in Vermont, New York, Maryland, and Oklahoma in exactly these circumstances. And the court said we can no longer confine our ability to reach a child's best interest under these circumstances. So either by putting that parent on an equal footing through the legitimate person test under these circumstances, or a de facto parenting status, or legal status.
In terms of the de facto parent, unless mm-hmm. we're sort of a pass-through, the panel can't necessarily find that the appellant's a de facto parent. Did you recognize that?
I do. And what I'm suggesting is the court doesn't have to embrace de facto parentage to reach the same result, to reach the result that allows any court to reach the child's best interests under these circumstances. And what the court said in Stettler was two things. One, we have no authority on which to find de facto parentage, and I would say that there is now intervening authority on which it could do so. But it also was ruling in a visitation case, which is very distinct from the facts here. And the court doesn't have to embrace de facto parentage to put these... What the court said in Stettler was, we have a person with a legitimate interest, and that protects the child's interests. We do it a different way. We don't need to embrace de facto parenthood. I'm suggesting the court can do get to the same result here under the Virginia test, or it could do what I believe it should do, which is recognize that both of these women are parents to this child. Even though there's a biological, a lack of biology or adoption, that doesn't, under Virginia law, mean that a parent can't be recognized. If you look at the assisted conception statute, biology is not a...
Didn't the trial court make a factual determination that it would be detrimental to the child to sever a relationship with the appellant?
It did. It did, Your Honor. And went on to find that the testimony, that the evidence that it was considering included the credible and persuasive evidence of an expert who said that harm has occurred based on severance and a list of harms that would occur.
Counsel, your time is up.
I see.
And you've used actually all your time, but I'm going to give you your full 5 minutes of it as well because we've peppered you with a lot of questions and I want to give you a fair opportunity to respond to what Mr. Ziegler has to say.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Ziegler.
It is now squarely in the afternoon, so good afternoon. Brandon Ziegler on behalf of the appellee, Darla Grease.
Counsel, if you start so early that we might as well get to what the issue is in reference to the special factors. The appellant brings up on its brief in over, which arguably is a custody situation, but why wouldn't that be analogous here to finding that the presumption is overcome? I understand it's visitation versus what we have here is custody,
no.
But aren't they analogous, or could they be argued to be analogous? And if so, why can't we rely on that?
I don't believe they're analogous, Your Honor. Let's go through the exceptional circumstances comes from Bales v. Sowers, which was decided in 1986, so 31 years ago. And they have already waived the first four elements, being unfitness, divestiture, voluntary relinquishment, abandonment. So those are not before us, and there's no evidence to indicate that they had any merit to bring those to begin with. So they're relying on facts and circumstances. 14 years after Bales, we have this little case called Troxler, Troxler versus Granville. In that case, the United States Supreme Court opines. And this is a critical analysis on how we interpret the special facts and circumstances element which you are addressing, Your Honor. And it says, it has been long recognized that a parent, and going to Judge Humphrey's opinion, a parent in Virginia is one of two, adoption or biology. There is no adoption. I have biology. There is no third option.
Well, except for the fact that it fails, it's a stepmother, so there's no adoption, there's no biology. So does that undercut your argument?
It does not. If we finish the Troxler analysis, it says, a parents have a fundamental right, a constitutional fundamental right, to make decisions concerning their child's care, custody, and control under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Further, there should not be any reason for a state to interject itself into the private realm of the family or to question the ability of a parent to make decisions regarding the child's upbringing so long as that party is fit. And they've already waived the fitness claim. So, Bales, 1986, 2000, we have Troxler. So now we look at exceptional circumstances, directly to your point. Every published opinion that I can find on exceptional circumstances deals with something that is akin to unfitness or abandonment. Drug use, failure to pay attention to the child for years.
That's not what the law says. The law also talks about special circumstances.
Sure. Agreed.
All right.
But what they are asking is akin to a live-in all-pair who happen to have a physical relationship with the parent, and that would be akin to a special facts and circumstances. In that case, Judge Humphreys, in your question to opposing counsel, you said, aren't we opening this up for anybody? That's exactly what would happen if we applied the special facts and circumstances in this particular case.
Well, it is important. Let me ask you this. I'm going to recite some facts, and you tell me whether you agree or disagree.
Yes, Your Honor.
Both parties plan to have a child, live together in a family relationship for 10 years.
Disagree into one aspect. My client attempted to have a child through in vitro for many years prior to the entry of the relationship with the appellant. The fact that it was medically unsuccessful does not change the fact that she attempted to have a child much before the relationship.
I'm not sure that's relevant. The point is that they both agreed for your client to be the biological mother.
I would disagree with that point. The answer is, and here's why, my client was attempting to get pregnant through science prior to entering this relationship, which is an issue here. And this is a girlfriend-girlfriend relationship, not wife-wife relationship, because there is no marriage. So the fact that she attempted to do so only means that she continued her attempt to get married with the acquiescence of her then-partner. Doesn't mean that they made a family decision, Your Honor. There's a difference.
Let's move on.
Yes, Your Honor.
They shared the parent-child bond. Do you agree with that?
At a certain point in time they did. They do no longer.
I understand that.
Well, I believe that's critical.
The testimony which the trial court accepted that the child would be harmed if the bond was severed with the appellant.
And that could be cured with the visitation argument, which is currently pending in the Virginia Beach Juvenile Court with a hearing.
I'm just asking you to say whether or not the statements are correct.
I disagree with the last statement, Your Honor, right, based on the evidence that
you
I have.
You jointly raised the child for a period of time.
That's a true statement, Your Honor.
Good. And even after separation for a period of time, they continued to jointly parent the child.
True statement, Your Honor.
All right. And the child considers appellant his mommy along with your client.
Disagree, Your Honor.
All right. The child bonded with the appellant?
At a period of time, no longer. Please remember, this is an ongoing case, so I'm...
No,
viewing it in
it's over 10 years plus once they've separated. Now, my last question is, trial court found that it was detrimental to the child to sever a relation with the appellant and a parent-child relationship existed. What else do you need to show a legitimate interest under the statute?
Well, Your Honor, we're confusing the language between the visitation statute and the custody statute. I have stipulated on the record on multiple hearings that the appellant is a person of legitimate interest to pursue visitation under the statute as we have it in Title 20. And we have not moved to strike that pleading. We have not moved for summary judgment on that pleading. We are proceeding on litigation on that. So does she have standing to seek visitation? Yes. Does she have standing to be the parent, which is defined in Virginia?
She
no.
Mentions custody and visitation, doesn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, under Title 20 it does. But traditionally, or not traditionally, through the case law that has been developed over the years, that standard deals with visitation. We're here dealing with a Bales or Sowers analysis done 14 years prior to Troxler. So now we're talking about the impingement of my client's constitutional rights to be the only parent as that is defined.
The statute recognizes another category of non-biological parent, right?
It recognizes that a non-biological person can stand in the shoes based on special facts and circumstances. It doesn't recognize another category of parent.
No.
It recognizes someone has stepped up and played an important role in a child's life, but they do not become a parent, Your Honor. That is defined in our code.
No, I understand that.
So when we look at the Bales v. Sowers case and its decisions, we have to look at it through the eyes of Troxler. To do so would be ignoring the United States Supreme Court and the constitutional right that my client enjoys as the only biological parent.
Mr. Ziegler, let me interrupt you asking this question. Clearly, in the case of a parent, recognized parentage, after a divorce, both parties can have joint custody.
Correct.
can that occur with a person of legitimate interest in a parent?
No.
Why not?
Because this a party of legitimate interest in this particular case, she has entitled to a visitation hearing, and upon proving actual harm through the appropriate testimony at the appropriate time, if she gets over that hurdle, because there's only one parent recognized in law, she would then be entitled to a determination of what's in the child's best interest and the trier of fact, because we don't have juries on this, the judge.
The statute talks about custody and visitation.
It does.
It doesn't. The statute doesn't prohibit joint custody between a parent and a person with a legitimate interest, does it?
No, Your Honor. It's granted all the time in the juvenile courts.
So why, that's my question. Why isn't it fair to consider, at least for the trial court to consider, joint custody between a parent and a person with a legitimate interest? You said that couldn't happen.
I apologize, Your Honor. I would mean it shouldn't happen in this case. It can happen, and the court does do it.
But in the abstract, it could. I mean, there would be no statutory prohibition.
I don't disagree, Your Honor. I apologize. I wasn't phrasing it correctly. I meant in this particular case. If you want to talk, if you want to open it up to abstract and all possibilities, the answer is yes.
So it comes down to whether the trial court, the circuit court in this case, Judge Rucci, applied the correct definition of special circumstances.
I think that is.
And if he did, then that's the end of it. And if he didn't, then there's a remand for that purpose.
I don't disagree with that analysis, Your Honor. And I believe that when we get to that, and we really separate the wheat from the chaff, if you will, to use a well-turned phrase, we get to the fact of a matter on appeal will not be disturbed unless they are plainly wrong without evidence to support it. Further, absent clear evidence to the contrary in the record, the judgment of the trial court comes to an appellate court with a presumption that the law was correctly applied to its facts, Bottoms v. Bottoms, 249 Virginia 410, 1995. I don't disagree, Your Honor, Judge Humphreys, with your exact definitions. Did Judge Frucci, after hearing trial for a day, apply the last element only under Bales or Sauer? Does this case rise to special facts and circumstances?
And after he made a finding that it would be detrimental to the child to sever the relationship and that a parent-child relationship existed, why isn't that sufficient to show that the appellant has a legitimate interest? What else is there?
There's plenty, Your Honor. And what I would argue respectfully to Judge Frucci is that that was dicta that doesn't have anything to do with where we are to get over the first threshold. When we look at the history of this court's opinions on Factor 5 in Bales v. Sowers, we have extreme circumstances. We have abandonment. We have drug use. We have imprisonment. We have sexual abuse. We have submitting the child to a sexual predator.
Well,
those were all.
That would be under a fitness that you're talking about.
Actually, all those were determined under Section 5, and some have a concurrent overlap with unfitness. Some have concurrent overlap with other factors in Bales or Sowers. But I have looked at every case that has cited Bales or Sowers and specifically identified Section 5 as its analysis.
And I guess what I'm indicating is that while Section 5, in terms of the circumstances, in those particular cases, there's also another element. You're usually the abandonment, or the drug usage, or the imprisonment. There's something else in combination, isn't there?
Generally, there is another aspect, but it usually has to do with the party not living up to the child's needs. And I understand that's a very broad and non-specific answer.
Is in terms of those cases and how they might be instructed, if there's another element that adds to the special facts and circumstances, I mean, is that instructive here?
I believe it is, because instead of looking at does that give you guidance, let's look at the flip side. What would happen if we don't have that guidance? Well, if we don't have that guidance, what we have is anybody is able at that point to take your question to this natural extent to fall under the special facts and circumstances Section 5 analysis because they happen to care for a child and they didn't even need to be living together. Plenty of relationships. I've done family law for 21 years. There's plenty of relationships where the two households need to be maintained for whatever reason, but one party helps care for the other party's children for a substantial period of time. After work, somebody works nights, someone works days. Someone is deployed. What would happen under the military analysis? We have a special forces who were gone for 12, 13, 14 months, and they have a friend who helps care for their children because they have a two-party, or they have two-income house. So now we are, if we expand the special facts and circumstances, we are now letting anybody and everybody say, I have a connection because. That's just not what parenting is about. We are forgetting and ignoring the direction of Troxler, and we cannot do that. The United States Supreme Court has said a constitution fundamental right. We also are forgetting that their case is about a lot of what-ifs. Well, what if they were allowed to marry? They weren't. Except they were in special cases. They could go to D.C. It's only a three-hour trip up 95, depending on traffic. See the monument, see the Smithsonian, get married. Take a trip to Maine. Go to Canada. There were other opportunities for them to do this, yet they didn't do it. So how strong was this? It is. No, because Obergefell was decided after they separated, Your Honor. So no, it would not have. But it would have supported their analysis that this was a family decision, which it was not. This was my client's decision prior to the relationship being formed, and she continued on her path with the acquiescence and agreement of her then partner. This is not a family decision. So that's a clear distinction that needs to get made. Second, they could have taken steps to indicate that this was a party who was going to remain in this child's life by getting married, even if it wasn't recognized in Virginia, or executing any documents to a trust and estate's attorney that this is where I want. There was no adoption done. There was no other indicia other than living together that the intent was for Ms. Hawkins to remain permanently involved in this child's life. And then they want to say it should be because they were constitutionally denied the right to marriage. This is not a gay rights case. This is not a gay marriage case. This is simply a custody case where the special facts and circumstances has to be viewed within the eyes of the decision of Troxler, and we cannot share my client's constitutional rights with anyone because the minute one iota of that is taken, she is deprived of those rights. And we cannot deprive her of her fundamental rights by sharing it with another party. I'm happy to answer any questions, but I see my time is up.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Ziegler. Thank you.
Ms. LaTroy, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. If I could, I'd like to clarify a few things. I'm starting at the end. First, the evidence in the record, in fact, shows that when the conversation about this planned family began, it began by Ms. Grease, and she asked Ms. Hawkins if she would like to become pregnant. And they decided that Ms. Grease, that they wanted to bring a child into their relationship, and Ms. Grease was chosen as the potential biological parent. That's in the record. That's in the transcript. And the purpose of the rule that protects a natural parent, you have to apply the facts and circumstances for exceptional circumstances under that rubric, in light of the purpose that it affects, which is to ensure that there's not government overreach, government intrusion into a family. Here, that has not occurred, and it doesn't occur under the facts of these circumstances. Every case that has been decided, and there are dozens post-Troxel with exactly these facts and circumstances, courts have said no constitutional violation of the natural parent's rights have occurred. Parental autonomy is personal to the parent, to that individual, and they can waive that right. And courts have found when you create a parent-child relationship, when you bring a child into your family unit and allow that child to have a parent-child relationship that they come to rely on, you have either waived those rights or relinquished them as to that other person. Troxel itself had 7 justices who opined that in the circumstances of someone with a significant parental interest in the child, that the conclusion would be different. There's also a constitutional violation here that has occurred as to Ms. Hawkins' rights and as to the child's rights. That this court, if it does not reverse...
That will depend on the definition of parent, though.
Not at all, Your Honor. The Supreme Court has said over and over again that biology does not create the family relationship that's protected. In fact, that's Obergefell, again, yes, it was a marriage ruling.
You can point to where Obergefell, Justice Kennedy, talked about the definition of parents.
The court did not treat the same-sex couples, when it was talking about the harm that was in, that was occurring to these children based on the lack of access to marriage, as a parent and a non-genetic parent.
It simply says that states may not discriminate based on gender when it comes to recognition of the marriage.
That absolutely. I don't disagree with that. I'm simply asking the court to look at its reasoning.
You're asking us to apply a lot of things from that, from the holding of Obergefell.
From the findings of Obergefell.
And at least, Virginia, for example, doesn't recognize common law marriages, even, mm-hmm. though we're a common law state. We don't recognize common law marriages. So our definition of marriage, for whatever, you know, whether you like it or not, is very narrow. General Assembly has seen fit to make it so. Now, I understand where you're coming from, but I don't see where Obergefell gets you there, frankly. I mean, it's had your clients married either after Obergefell or in another state, as Mr. Ziegler points out, it seems to me you'd have a better position here, you know, even though Virginia at the time did not recognize same-sex marriage, you know, a custody or visitation a hearing being held after Obergefell, I think would put your client in a lot better situation. That isn't the case here, it seems to me.
To place on this couple who were denied access, any path to parenthood from the non-biological parent at the time the child was born, where you could not go to D.C. and become married, but to place that kind of burden on this family is not necessary and is
We're not placing any burden on anybody. We're simply trying to interpret the law as it exists. Now, again, I mean, you could go to the General Assembly, and I suppose, you know, get their cooperation, you could change the law tomorrow, and
where
they convene,
then
we wouldn't be having this discussion right now.
I'm not sure that I understand that line of logic. But
I mean, if the General Assembly redefined parentage along the lines that you would like it to be, it wouldn't be necessary for us to have this discussion right now.
It would be too late to help this child, and this child has been harmed. The decisions of the natural parent here, the presumption is to ensure that their rights aren't violated. The rights here aren't violated because of her own actions in creating a parent-child relationship from before the child was born. That's a fact that's critical to distinguish the circumstances, the litany of horribles that have been laid out. This is not about boyfriends and girlfriends, nannies, caretakers, grandparents. This is about a parent who chooses to bring another parent into that child's life before the child is even born, allow that child to attach as a parent, and then to sever that relationship in a way that the judge found is harmful to the child. That in and of itself shows that the presumption she acts in the child's best interest has been overcome. The constitutional rights, Your Honor, just to be clear, there is a due process right to a family association. I would just point the court to look at Smith versus Organization of Foster Families, to look at the cases in which biology alone has been found not to be the only way for the court to recognize constitutional rights.
Mr. Chair, we understand your argument. Thank you. For your benefit, our tradition on this court is to come down after oral arguments and brief counsel. And we'll pick up the next case. We'll do that now.